So, I certainly feel moved this moment to be sitting here with you and have the opportunity to somehow address you. And I think I'm most moved with the gratitude. I feel a lot of thank you for all of you. And so, also very aware that we're now 5-6 days into the retreat, and maybe it's partly why what I'm about to say, don't be worried, but then partly why I don't feel like saying much. I feel that somehow it would be more to the point or more profound, a deeper teaching to not speak and let something, you know, silence has so many different things to say. And sometimes silence says a lot about freedom, a lot about a certain kind of intimacy and depth of practice. So it would be nice if maybe I could just be silent and let that be the teaching today. Maybe having this feeling is also a consequence of the topic that somehow I ended up with here. And the topic for today is refuge in Nibbana, refuge in Nirvana in Buddhist English. And so to go back to this idea of refuge, it's such a very rich, multifaceted topic for Buddhists. It has many different meanings or many different ways to be experienced, many different ways to be practiced. And probably one person is not going to exhaust all the possibilities of this very rich word. It's so many connotations. And part of it can be emotional. And some people might say that it can involve a religious feeling. And what is a religious feeling is also maybe very multifaceted, and some people have nothing to do with the idea of religious feelings, and some people will have very different associations what this feeling is for other people. But the one way that the tradition talks about it that's closer to a feeling, a religious emotion, is that refuge is found in your heart. There's a seat in the heart that we sit in when we take refuge. So it's something very personal, and here again it's pointing to something within oneself, and that's where maybe even where the emotion resides or even where it arises out of. Something in our own heart. And so refuge in this way is interpreted to be something that's heartfelt, or something that is we feel like we can do, so we can be involved in wholeheartedly or in a heartfelt way. And I know that doesn't say much except that it points to some kind of emotional connection or some kind of integral way in which the connection to refuge is something deep inside that we have. I think of the refuge sometimes as being our teacher. The refuges can become our teachers, and that's why we take refuge in them, because they're there to teach us and guide us and support us. And so we see that in whatever way, whatever the Buddha means in this regard, when we take refuge in the Buddha, there's something there that is reliable as our teacher. Whatever dharma might mean, we recognize there's something there that's reliable as our teacher or as our guide. And whatever sangha might mean, there's something about sangha that is reliable as our teacher, as a guide for us. That it has something to show us. So all these point us in a direction or orient us, as Diana said, or as provide us with a sense of meaning or purpose, or provide us with a pointer to freedom. So one of the things we can take refuge in, before I say this, refuge in Nibbana, in freedom itself. One of the tradition sometimes talks about the refuge as a cave. And I think the idea as a cave is not some kind of dark, frightening place to go in where, but rather a cave that's a protection. And there's a long tradition of Buddhists taking up residency in caves. And there's still, you can find archaeological sites in India where canyons that are filled with caves that were sometimes carved out of the sandstone that monastics would live and practice for centuries. And I met a man who had spent a monk, many years living in a cave in Thailand. And when I looked into his eyes or saw his eyes, I was so inspired. Like, oh, this, there was depth and freedom and a kind of powerful kind of absence, just in the best senses of the term, absence of conceit, absence of greed and hatred. And wow, this was something to meet this man who'd spent... the host would like to unmute me. I got muted? I didn't do that. Did we miss a lot, what I said? Here I was teaching silence and absence. And so I talked about... So this man that lived in a cave, so... Sometimes refuge is called a cave that is a place of safety. Safety, and in a cave in the mountains, you can go into that cave when it's raining or when it's thunder and lightning or maybe when there's dangerous animals outside, that the cave provides safety from the rain, from the thunder, the lightning. And one of the things I appreciate about caves that's often underappreciated is what makes a cave is an absence. There's no mountain isn't in the cave. It's the absence, little space where there's mountain doesn't exist. The stone is not there. And it's that absence in the mountain that creates the safety. And there's something about absence that is very profound in the Dharma. And to begin to appreciate absences, so to appreciate the absence of greed, if we've been caught up in greed and lust for some time, and then to feel no longer there, our mind has not been hijacked or held hostage by desire, and we feel the absence of desire, the absence of greed, ah, we can breathe. We've kind of come back to ourselves. Ah, this is so good. Or the absence of hatred, hostility, resentment, irritation. And some people, of course, this is such an integral part of their life that this is who they think they are. But it can be such a wonderful thing to find that hatred, hostility, ill will is no longer there. Ah, I'm back. Oh, now I'm back. Now I'm back in myself. Or same with delusion. The absence of it can let us breathe more fully. We can have our breath back. We can have ourselves back in a certain kind of way with that absence. So cave is I appreciate the absence that the cave implies. And so to take refuge in a cave, to take refuge in a place where there's absence of something, that provides safety. maybe the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. There's some kind of safety that comes when we don't get caught in greed or hatred or delusion. And, you know, certainly it's in safety from ourselves, but it feels safer to be greed-free than it is to be with greed. Safer to be hostility-free rather than be with hostility. Safer to be delusion-free than to be with delusion. And in terms of we ourselves being our own refuge, the place where we can make ourselves a refuge, and that's the most reliable place of refuge that we can go to, is the refuge from ourselves being caught up in attachments and clinging and grasping and resistance and closing down and contracting. And Diana said yesterday, you know, many people go to nature and to all kinds of things in the world for refuge. But the Buddha said those are not really the reliable refuge. I'm very aware, regularly enough, that I live only a few miles from the San Andreas Fault. So those of you not from California, it's one of the major fault lines in California. It caused a 1906 earthquake. And it's kind of due for another shake. We used to have our sitting group in Portola Valley at a place that was smack on top of the San Andreas Fault. It couldn't be more on top of it. And it used to be a school with an auditorium. And when they realized what they had done, they closed it down as a school, and they made it work as a community center until they figured out what to do with it. And so they let us use the auditorium on Sunday mornings for our Sunday morning sitting group. So take refuge in nature, yes, but be careful. For many of us, it's very profound, the connection to nature, the natural world, and will you take a kind of refuge in it? But do it a little bit cautiously. If you're taking refuge in nature right on top of the San Andreas Fault, you know, you should kind of do it. I hope you're wise how you're doing it. So, but to take nature, take refuge in yourself, that's where something, you know, and so this Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha can't be very far from yourself if it's going to be reliable. To this cave. So a cave in the mountains. Now, one of the images for someone who's fully liberated, fully free and arhat, is they become like a mountain. So they're no longer the cave, but they're the mountain. And it's said that someone who is fully liberated is not frightened by the rain and the thunder and the lightning. So maybe they don't need a cave anymore. Now they're the mountain. Now mountain is taken here, the metaphor has meant great stability and strength. So rather than an arhat becoming like, you know, Mr. Nobody, who's barely there. Here in this metaphor, they're like something strong and powerful. There's a metaphor, another metaphor for, or analogy for an arhat, or for liberation, a liberated person. And it's that of a serpent. In India, I think certain serpents, like cobras, were seen as very powerful beings. What in the world is Buddhism doing? Making a metaphor out of a cobra or a powerful snake for an enlightened person. Maybe these enlightened people are dangerous. In what way are they dangerous? I was wondering today, what way are they dangerous? When there's no conceit and no arrogance and no attachments to anything and no tendency towards greed, no hatred. What makes that kind of person dangerous? maybe because they're not afraid of telling the truth. Or maybe because their very way of being suggests that maybe you could be that way too. It kind of shows you maybe that how different you are and what you're still caught in and attached to. And it was, you know, it kind of frightening because it kind of like upsets the status quo for yourself. And some people don't want to be too free because how's their marriage going to work out, or how's their, you know, going to work out at work, you know? At work, you know, you don't want to be too free at work. The idea of being content at work is, that's not very popular. Because you're supposed to have a certain level of discontent to work hard to get a promotion and get a raise and to, you know, and but you know, to come to, it's here in Silicon Valley, you know, to go to work and comes 5 o'clock when the end of the day and, oh, that was a good day, I feel content, I'll go home now and do something different. I mean, the eyes are going to go wide. And it's like, what? We're just beginning the day. We have a, you know, new product that's going to go out next week, or we have a new, you know, this and that. And, you know, 5 o'clock, you just, you know, we're just getting started here. We're supposed to be at least until 11 o'clock at night. Oh, that's okay, I feel content. Well, then you're not going to get the bonus. Well, that's okay. I'm content without a bonus. I've known people who've actually said that. You know, I don't need a bonus. And they don't get the bonus. Everyone else gets the bonus, but they don't, because they were content to go to home at 5 o'clock. So it's kind of dangerous, this freedom thing. It's threatening to all kinds of things that we think are important. So the enlightened person is a cobra and a snake. I don't think they're really dangerous, but what they stand for maybe is threatening for some people. So Nibbana as a refuge, liberation as a refuge. And one of the synonyms for Nibbana is non-clinging. To have non-clinging as a refuge. To have non-clinging as something that arouses a spiritual or religious emotion. To have non-clinging as something that is really the most heartfelt thing we know and something we can really put our heart into. Yes. We can say yes to non-clinging. To see non-clinging as our teacher, as what guides us and teaches us. To see non-clinging as the direction of our life, the orientation. Perhaps even a sense of purpose and meaning that takes greater importance than anything else. Non-clinging. The cessation of clinging, the cessation of craving, the cessation of conceit, the cessation of greed, the cessation of hatred, the cessation of delusion. Those become the refuge. And all that, to hear this word cessation, the ending, the absence of. And here we see again that the refuge is in an absence, not in a presence. Nibbana is a radical absence. And this also is frightening, upsetting for some people, because it's inconceivable that the highest ideal, that what we're setting ourselves out to, is a nothing, is an absence. We want so much a presence. we want a something that we can know, like we can touch and feel or sense or imagine or be with, something that's going to do it for us. For people who do meditation practice, it's not uncommon for people to look for, are looking for an experience. They're looking for the right experience. The experience is going to be the key. The experience is going to unravel all our problems. An experience is going to do it for us. And what is that experience? They're looking for that experience, and certainly the people who are teachers, they have it. They know what that experience is. There's an it. And in some, I know in some Buddhist traditions I've been in, when I was in Zen, you had this strong feeling that there was an it. No one really knew what the it was, and it was kind of, you couldn't really admit that you didn't know what it is. It was kind of like everyone was supposed to know what it was, so you couldn't admit that you didn't know what it was. But certainly the teacher knew what it was. But this it was kind of this mysterious thing, and there was this power in the mystery that was rather unfortunate, that was rather kind of a mystery, that an allure, a charisma, a something out there that we were all supposed to be in kind of an awe of or thought was really wonderful, and gave the teacher a lot of power because the teacher knew what it was and we didn't know what it was, but we couldn't admit we didn't know what it was, and so we went along as if we knew what it was. It's kind of crazy in some spiritual circles. The it, the mysterious thing, the thing. Or we're looking for, so we're looking for something that's going to do it. So it's rather, that's why it's so dangerous, this enlightenment thing in Theravada and Buddhist tradition. It turns out it's not an experience. In the usual way, it's not a thing, it's not a presence of something. It isn't like this reward that's waiting for you. You find you get this thing, and now you have it. There's nothing to have. There's nothing to get. In some real way, there's nothing to attain, nothing to attain. One of the titles or words that for a fully liberated person in our tradition, you know, just like we have the word arhat that some people know, the most common kind of title for them. But another one that's not used that often, but maybe it's not so popular, is akinchano. And there's a wonderful teacher in Germany named Akinchino. Some of you might have heard of him. It means nothing. I mean, literally it means the word, you know, quotations, nothing. No thing. So someone who is an arhat, someone who is fully liberated, is nothing. Connected to no thing. There's nothing there. So should have said this on the first day of the retreat, so you could have gone home and given up on all this, because this is like not good news. And nothing. No experience, no nothing. But it's the best. That's why we take refuge in it. It's the best thing going. But it's, you know, it's the best thing. What is it? This Nibbana. It's a radical, powerful, significant absence. To know this absence is to be changed by it. To know non-greed so well that after that you'll never again be convinced that greed is valuable, that greed is worthwhile. Or you might still have greed, but you'll see it and say, nope, I know, I don't believe in it anymore. I don't see its value anymore. In fact, what I see is how it diminishes me, how it disempowers me, how it closes me. There's a loss, actually, in greed. We have a powerful enough experience of the absence of hostility, hate, ill will, aversion, that after that, after this absence of it, really feeling it, knowing the absence, and knowing, then knowing so clearly, it's no longer worth being involved in hostility, in aversion. It's just not cut out. It's overrated. It has no real value that you want to stand behind and do. There still might be a tendency towards ill will, towards hostility, but you know you're no longer convinced by it. You know in your heart, this is not where I want to be. Where I want to be is in an absence, in this space where it's not there. The same thing with delusion. To have a clear enough experience of non-delusion, that delusion is not cut out, not something you want to do anymore. Or a clear experience of non-clinging, or a clear enough experience of non-craving, clear enough experience of absence of conceit, of arrogance, that you're never again convinced that these are valuable. And this becomes, as a refuge, becomes an orientation, a guiding light, it becomes your teacher, it becomes something that's you almost have religious emotions around the value of this absence. And it becomes a protection. Refuge is also a protection. It's a protection. It's a protection from not getting falling into the dangers that come with greed, the dangers that come with hostility, with delusion, with clinging, with craving, with conceit, all these things. And it's a powerful thing to be able to, and a challenging thing in practice, to come to the place where we see the two paths that fork. One may be the usual one, going down to the directions of clinging or craving, being attached to things, stuck to things, stickiness there, and that which doesn't. And people can waffle there for a long time, and some people actually will choose to attachment and clinging because it's comforting, it feels safe, it's what's familiar. And it's also what is supported by the people around them. Family, friends, can, you know, that's what they expect. They expect the old you, what came along with clinging and craving, and that's what they recognize, that's what they understand, that's how the game is played. So it's just this waffling, what do I do here, you know? What do I choose? Which direction do I go? To take refuge in Nibbana is to take refuge in trust and value, have faith in the non-clinging, the non-attachment, the non-hate, the non-greed. They're not going in that direction. So it's not, you know, so in some ways our religious tradition, this Theravadan religious tradition, is in some kind of way, that's kind of, I find delightful, it has a certain kind of religious poverty. because other religions have these great, wonderful experiences, communion and oneness with the universe, and all kinds of things. And we have some pretty wonderful things, but but ultimately we don't have much. In fact, we even call it akinshino. It's nothing. Go to a cocktail party and they say, "What's your religion all about?" And you say, "Nothing." You know, then people kind of back off and go find someone else who's more exciting to talk to. I kind of like it that we have this kind of nothing thing going on, because so we don't get too excited about our religion, which in the earliest records of the Buddha's teachings, probably the earliest records that we have, it's remarkable how he one of his big messages was, don't take anything as ultimate. Religious people generally want to have something which is ultimate, the ultimate teaching, the ultimate understanding, the ultimate something. But the Buddha said, don't take anything as ultimate, and don't argue about what's ultimate. Don't debate it. Rather, he said, just don't cling to things. That was his core message. And then he talked about four things that people cling to. And maybe he had this idea that these were pretty central to the categories for clinging. And these four, the first is to, it's usually translated into English as sensual pleasure. And some people will clearly understand that they're a little bit over-concerned with sensual pleasure. But I think some people don't quite understand this. But I think it's anything to do with being comfortable. There's nothing inherently wrong with being comfortable, but it's one of the attachments is to comfort. And some people don't think they're involved in sensual pleasure when they go to the supermarket and buy their groceries. But it's usually because things taste good that we buy things. That's one of the criteria, and that's a pursuit of pleasure, tasting good. Or we buy clothes that are a little more expensive than we need to buy because it brings us pleasure to wear them. And it's innocent enough to do that, but it's actually the pursuit of pleasure, of delight, and this kind of sensual joy is a very common, such a common human phenomena that the Buddha called the human realm the realm of sensual desire because of how common it is. And again, there's nothing wrong with sensual pleasure. What the Buddha was focusing on is the clinging to it, the attachment to it. And it's one of the common attachments. And to discover how to not believe in the value of sensual pleasure, not to give it ultimate value, not to think only if I have the sensual pleasure will I feel satisfied, content, feel successful, feel like everything's okay. The second clinging is the clinging to that usually translated as views. And it's usually understood to be philosophical views about religion and life and religious views. I like to expand it out to be are the stories we live by, stories we tell ourselves, the opinions we have. And they can be very intense clinging to being right, to the opinions we have. Very intense clinging and holding on to stories, our interpretation of what happened, and it's this way, it really is this way. And clinging to events that happened in our past. Some people cling to how they were hurt. Some people cling to how they did great, wonderful things. So the views, the stories, the opinions, the philosophies, the beliefs that we have, they can be quite intense, the clinging to it. And then there's also clinging, and I love this next one, clinging to ethical rules and to religious practices. Like what? You mean I'm not supposed to be ethical? And I'm not supposed to be involved in religious practices? What's going on with these Buddhists? I mean, first they tell me to come to a retreat and practice mindfulness, and now they tell me, you know, don't cling to and we took the precepts at the beginning of the retreat, and now I'm told, don't cling to ethics and don't cling to religious practices? That's right. But don't not do them. You should still be ethical. And religious practices are still useful. Just don't put too much emphasis on them. Don't depend on them too much. Don't cling to them. They have a role on the path to liberation, but they themselves are not liberating. They themselves are conditions that support us to be at the edge of liberation, but they don't bring us liberation. And some of us get to the edge or get to the recognize that place sooner than others. And generally it's the place where we realize we have to let go. It's the letting go that's liberating. It's the release of the clinging. So the Buddha says it's important not to cling to ethics and religious practices, because it can paradoxically can be the very thing that gets in the way of our freedom. And the final thing he talked about was clinging to attavada, philosophies of self, doctrines of self, beliefs in self. And so, you know, few of us believe that we have philosophies of self that we're living by. But in fact, I think everyone does, and every culture has them. Their cultures provide them, but they're kind of implicit in language, implicit in how people behave and relate to each other. So, for example, in certain parts of culture in the United States, there are strong streaks of individualism. And there's almost, you know, people have written treatises on the benefits or the appropriateness of strong individualism, and you know, really been the themes of books and movies of individualistic kind of emphasis and the importance of discovering oneself and all this in an individualistic way. And it really took to me going to Japan and living for a year in a culture which is a collectivist culture and not an individualistic culture, that I could really see clearly what a strong individualistic streak that I had grown up in and I had been acculturated in, that had been invisible to me until then. So the philosophy of self, the beliefs in self, the how we organize the self, is often quite invisible. And then one of the functions of getting very concentrated and still in meditation, it's kind of a deconstruction process, is to see how we construct the self-idea, the self-philosophy, the self-doctrine, these ideas of self we organize ourselves around. So it's not saying we get attached to self, it's saying we get attached to these beliefs about what the self is. And so to discover non-clinging to sensual pleasure, to discover non-clinging to opinions and philosophies, beliefs, to discover non-clinging to ethics and religious practices, to discover non-clinging to any doctrine of self. And then taking refuge in the non-clinging. To take refuge in that freedom from those. And even if we still cling, it's because we still cling that sometimes the refuge in the non-clinging is so helpful and supportive and inspiring. Instead of saying, oh, poor me, I'm still clinging, and I was clinging last week, I was clinging yesterday, I was clinging an hour ago, I'm just like a professional clinger. It seems like I'm like pretty good at it. I've been practicing it for a long time, and since that's what I'm good at, I might as well keep it up, and maybe I'll get a badge, an award for one of the best clingers on the block, or something. This is too difficult, it's too difficult to overcome clinging, and I just go back to it, and it's easier just to cling, because it's so second nature, and I know it gets me in trouble, but it's just easier. But to take refuge in non-clinging, to see that as something that, rather than being depressed by the clinging, yes, you say, yes, I do cling. That's true. And I no longer believe in it. That's a huge step. Even if we still cling, to no longer believe in it is valuable. And then take refuge in the absence of it. Even if all it is an intuition of that absence, or a memory that we've had that absence at some point in our life, but to have this heartfeltness, this inspiration, this orientation, this guidance from non-clinging. Non-clinging is possible. Non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion is possible. It's not very far away. And sometimes you can intuitive or smell it or sense it or feel just there, just outside. It's just beyond the clinging. And rather than being upset that it's just beyond the clinging and here I am clinging again, take refuge is to be inspired, gladdened, protected by this wonderful reference point of non-clinging, of freedom. So, here we are at the fifth day, full day of the retreat. And it's been 5 days of the absence of some things in your life. That's usually what retreat means. I hope it's been the absence of TV, sitcoms. I hope it's been the absence of news, tracking the news. I hope it's been the absence of putting aside some of the usual concerns. Maybe it's the absence of work for some of you, and it's kind of a vacation from that. Maybe it's been the absence from some of your personality. Some of the things you've been so concerned with and had been concerned with before the retreat, some of it's abated and quieted down. Then maybe now and here on the fifth full day, maybe there's a possibility of you taking refuge in absence. Take refuge in non maybe not non-clinging, but maybe it's more modest, non-preoccupation. Or maybe it's taking refuge in no longer believing in the value of these preoccupations, clingings, attachments. And that makes a world of difference that you don't believe in it. It's actually quite valuable. And so one of the things I'm trying to get across here in this talk is that don't be blinded by the presence of things. There is a bright light that shines on us when we can appreciate the absence, and the absence of believing in these clinging. To not believe is a bright light that shines itself on the darkness of clinging. So whatever degree to which you no longer believe, no longer stand behind clinging, behind hatred, behind craving, conceit, whatever it might be, celebrate that. Let that warm your heart. Be inspired by that. Be guided by that. So that that gently, quiet, that silence, that quiet voice, that quietude, or that sweetness of that absence, that it becomes a gentle beckoning, gentle welcoming to you. It's okay, my dear friend. It's okay that you cling. Don't worry about it too much. Don't believe in it. But come here. Please come into non-clinging. It's where you're safer here. And if you can't come all the way, that's okay. There is some absence here already, the non-believing in the value of greed, hate, and delusion. Such a powerful thing. And then perhaps here on the fifth day and tomorrow the sixth day of the retreat, perhaps you can be a little bit more attuned, a little bit more attentive to all the little moments through the day where there is significant dharmic absence. A little moment where maybe a bird suddenly started chirping outside your window, and maybe it was only 2 seconds of listening to it, and then you realize, hey, wait a minute. There was no greed listening. Maybe in the third second there was greed, but for 2 seconds there was none. Or maybe there was no hostility for a few moments, no aversion. Or maybe you were so clear about the moment, there was no delusion. I suspect there's lots of little moments throughout the day that go unnoticed because we're so interested in the presence of things. Thinking is so much about things, we seldom tune in to the absence. I propose to you that you have lots of experience of absence of clinging. Little micro moments at the minimum. So maybe here on the fifth day and the sixth day, there can be a quiet settling in and a gentle kind of opening and trusting, discovering the small movements of non-clinging as they occur, as they move through you, as they occur moment here and there. Tune into those. Notice them, appreciate them, celebrate them. Think of them as your teacher. Thank you for the lesson. Let the lesson sink in. Let the lesson really work for you. So this is the refuge in Nibbana. This is the refuge in Nirvana, which is available to all of us. And in some ways is the culmination of refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, and refuge in ourselves. So thank you. And I end the talk with the same feelings of gratitude for all of you as I began. Great appreciation for you, and thank you, and carry on.